Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with Andrew Hunter-Murray, James Harkin, and Anna Tyshinsky. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one. And looky, looky, it's Anna Tyshinsky.
My fact this week is that wild oats sow themselves. What? Yeah, so basically they're plants that look a bit like oats and they have seeds at the top of them that come in a little cluster that's called a panicle. Mm-hmm. But they don't panic. They very calmly have two spikes sticking out of them called awns, and they look a bit like very long hairy legs. And basically when the seeds come off, they go onto the ground, and when they dry out, they twist one way, and when they get moist, they twist another. So as the moisture goes up and down, they twist back and forth. And it reminded me a bit of one of those moves you used to do in gym where you lie on your back and splay your legs out and roll around.
You're not allowed back in that gym anymore, are you?
We just sort of did the bleep test and stuff at my school.
Yeah, our teacher was sacked, actually. But they sort of, it makes them sort of crawl around, and then they'll find a crevice eventually. They'll fall into a crevice. And once they've fallen into a crevice, this motion makes them drill down into it. So they literally bury themselves.
It's the closest thing you'll see to something that's not sentient being absolutely sentient. It just looks like
Let's
it's got a mind.
Let's not get into your sentience and trees stuff.
I think it's alive, guys. I think
it is
alive.
No, honestly, it is alive.
Well, there we go. James agrees. What about you two?
Wild oats, are they the ancestors of the oats that we eat?
We think so, although there seems to be some disagreement, but I think they are, yes. Although the oats that we eat, the cultivated oats, have lost these awns because they're bred right. out so the seeds can get much bigger.
And wild oats are, I think, a weed.
Yes.
Right? And yeah. they're quite annoying because they can plant themselves. Yeah. And so the idea of sowing wild oats is something that you would never need to do it because they do it themselves, but also you wouldn't want to do it because it gets in the way of all your normal plants. Mm. So sowing wild oats became a phrase that meant just doing something pointless and stupid.
Yeah.
Oh.
So go out and have fun in a promiscuous sexual way because you're not going to marry these people, but go out and do that and then find the person you're going to marry.
Yeah. So it was not originally sexual as well. It was just people having fun and messing around and stuff. And actually, an interesting thing that I found is that the word haver, which I've only ever heard in the song I'm Gonna Walk 500 Miles by Proclaimers. Yeah. You know, if haver. I haver, yeah. then I know I'm gonna haver with you or whatever it is.
Mm. Okay.
That the word haver means oats, and havering means sort of messing around, not doing anything properly. Mm. And it's the same origin as this wild oats.
Oh, wow. Oh my God. So that means that we have a new sentence person to add to my list, Nigel Havers.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Really?
That's a thrill. Anna, I've been updating the list.
Oh, have you? I was going to say, it's been a long time.
Anna, there's a new list.
Don't worry, we'll get onto the new list.
I'm okay. I think it ended up meaning something immoral really early, though, because by the turn of the 17th century, so from the late 16th century, wild oats, plural, weirdly, was a term for a dissolute and immoral man. So you'd Ooh. Say he's a bit of a wild oats.
Yeah, the earliest use is by someone called Thomas Beacon. From the 16th century, and he talks about certain light brains and wild oats, and he's talking about stupid people, basically, or idiots. And he also coined the terms bucketful, epicurism, omnisufficient, 17thly, unbearded, and worsest.
Honestly, I think bucketful is the big hitter for me of that list.
Yeah. I just love worsest.
I think worsest is definitely the worsest of them all.
So there are four kinds of wild oats, right?
Yeah.
They're all Avena something. Avena sativa, Avena byzantine, Avena strigos. Those last two are mostly just to feed animals. But there's a fourth kind, Avena abyssinica, which I read is only partly domesticated.
Ooh, it's a bit disobedient.
I don't really know what it means, but I just like it so much.
Of course, according to some people, they are still only animal feed. Or according to Samuel Johnson 300 years ago, who famously said he described the oat, the normal oat, as a grain which in England is generally given to horses, but in Scotland appears to support the people.
It's not one of his good ones.
Well, I think snobby. It is. It's one of his most famous ones, isn't it? And he later wrote to Boswell, his friend. He wrote, "I meant to vex them about that particular thing."
Knew
and
it.
He did it on purpose to wind the Scots up.
Yeah.
So annoying.
Please,
but they were a big Scottish thing, weren't they? They thrived in the Scottish climate and all of that, and they were grown in huge quantities.
Brought over by the Romans, right? So they weren't there until the Romans got there, and then the climate was just so perfect because it was wet, sunny. It was long day, short day. It just perfectly suited it, and that sort of became the thing of what Scottish people were brought up on.
Yeah, and saved Britain during the war to a certain extent.
Second World War,
you know, obviously big deal of cutting off food supplies and cutting off Atlantic food convoys and things like that, and oats became a really big deal. They were you know, they substituted a lot of the wheat that you then couldn't get back then. White bread was illegal.
Was it?
Yeah.
Did you have to eat oat bread? Because that's quite different to wheat bread, isn't it?
I can't remember.
Surely
what the
porridge.
The oats were used for. There was a thing called the national loaf, which was just very, I think, very, very good for you bread, but obviously not very delicious.
Although it sounds like a sort of Reform Party piece of Reform Party merchandise.
National loaf. There's brose, which is a kind of porridge that you don't cook. It's just cold water and oatmeal together.
Okay. We should start like a bros podcast.
That's such a good idea. It's porridge.
It's a load of jocks eating porridge.
Oh, such bad timing, Anna. You just came back.
No, really sad not to be involved in that, but it wouldn't make sense, would it?
Oats had a renaissance since the 90s, hasn't it? It sort of appears everywhere in different things. Now, oat milk particularly. Oh, yeah. That was invented in the 90s. I thought we had that for a very long time. Ricard Ost, O-S-T-E, which is almost an anagram of oats. Yeah. He's a Swedish scientist, and as well as inventing it, he is a professor at Lund University, where we will be going very soon to be doing our live show.
Is he still trading? Is he?
He's still there, so we could meet him. But he only spends 20% of his time there at the university. So hopefully we land in that 20%.
So he's doing one day a week, I think is what you mean.
His official biography says he only spends 20% of his time.
That's a translation thing.
Wait a minute. No, because there's 7 days in a week.
That's a good point. So he must do, I suppose, 1.4.
Yeah, 1.4 days.
So hopefully we're there on the 1.4 day. We'll see.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I didn't actually know how they made oat milk. It's just because I've never thought about it. We always have some in the house, but I thought it was just they're dry. I mean, I suppose there is moisture in there. If
you zoom in, there's those tiny udders hanging off each grain.
But they mix it with water. Of course they do.
Do they?
Yeah, and they make it into a kind of suspension of water.
So they make it
into
porridge, right?
Yeah.
Watery porridge. And then they take out the oats.
Yeah, I suppose that's it. Yeah, okay. But that's how they do it.
It sounds gross when you say it like that, and I bet it wouldn't work if I did it, but I quite like it.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah. I looked up cereal bars. I got a bit distracted.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Just on when things were invented. Dan, you were surprised that oat milk was a 90s invention. The first cereal bar, any guesses?
Okay. Oh. 20,000 BC.
Okay. Not... later.
They found some in a cave in South Africa.
They found the wrapper. So I will say, I don't know if it's surprising enough to justify a quiz.
I think it would be more surprising if it was very late, because cereal bar could just be you drop some honey on two bits of grain, couldn't it?
I mean, is it the 80s, Andy?
It's 1981. Okay.
Amazing.
That is surprising.
I'm amazed.
It is late, isn't it?
It's
later than I thought.
That's late.
I'm astonished.
It was called Cereal Crunchy. And that means, of course, that David Niven or Muddy Waters could both have enjoyed a cereal.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Oh, there's too much to catch Anna up on.
Is this a new bit?
It's actually the very new bit, in fact. Mm. A two-week-old baby would be old enough to remember when Andy invented this new bit.
Right, okay.
Speaking of cereal, mm-hmm. They used to be called Cheerios.
Oh.
Did they?
But Quaker Oats owned the idea of having oats in cereal, so they had to remove the T and call themselves Cheerios instead.
Oh, wow. Oh, really? Yeah. Is that why Ready Breck, which I've never understood what that is, but it doesn't have oats in it in the title?
Oh, yeah.
Even though surely that's also porridge.
But is it oats?
Mm. Yeah, it's porridge.
Don't
Ready Breck.
Have the Quaker lot trademarked oats as a foodstuff?
Largely speaking, they have. Now, I think probably if your thing is made out of oats, then it would be hard to argue that you can't call it oats. But obviously, in one or two cases, they have pushed it.
Like Scott's Porridge Oats.
Yeah.
My preferred brand.
Mm-hmm.
It's just called, that's called oats. That's allowed.
Yeah. It could be like that's in the UK, for instance, whereas Cheerios would have been in America, where, of course, Quaker Oats began. And also not made by Quakers.
Not even blooming Quakers.
Yeah.
Can't believe that. I think the Quakers need to sue them.
Mm.
They just made up the name Quaker because it sounds really ironically honest and full of integrity.
They didn't make up the name.
they didn't invent the word Quaker.
Apparently one of them read an encyclopedia article on Quakers and thought, oh, they sound great. I'm going to call my cereal after them.
You wouldn't do it these days, I think.
No?
Just pick a religion and name
your cereal after. Scientologist flakes.
There was a company called Early Bird who got sued because they named one of their products Haulin Oats, H-A-U-L-I-N.
That's good.
And they got sued by Hall and Oats, the band. Yeah. Daryl Hall. Yeah.
I think that's reasonable.
Fair enough because they've obviously taken their name.
Yeah.
Rolled Oats.
Oh, yeah.
And Steel Cut Oats. Any prefs?
If I was to see them both on the shelf.
Yep.
And I wanted to get some very special oats because Andy's coming round to stay over.
Yep.
And I know that he loves his oats and I want to get him something special. I would go for the rolled oats because I feel like it's more done by a caveman with a big stone and rolled it over to make it work.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, actually, steel cut are the least processed. They've just been sliced around a bit. The rolled ones have been steamed a bit, I think, and rolled into a flake. So if you want to go with classic, the hardest possible one to cook, you want steel-cut oats, which is what I use. Oats are very good for one medical condition, and you have to get into a big bath full of oats to cure it.
Oh, I know, because we had it recently.
Go on.
Chickenpox.
Oh, no.
Oh, well.
Okay, so there are two conditions that can be cured by oats. I was talking about sunburn.
Really?
Must be the same kind of soothing skin thing.
Apparently, you make a nice cool bath, drop a load of oats in it, and then you get in. So you basically are the porridge.
Interesting.
That's pretty cool.
No, you're like the little blob of jam.
You're the blob of jam, for sure. That's it.
You're not the oats, yeah.
That's really interesting. Do you know that in Scotland, they would make oatmeal poultices for minor boils? So what you would do is you would get the oatmeal and you would put some butter in it and you would boil it up and then you would cool it and then you would put it against your boils. And if the boils were really difficult, then you would use urine instead of butter.
Okay. Oh, no, I think it's fine. I think actually it's not that bad, Doctor. I think it's fine. I think I'll have the oats, please.
They're also good, apparently, for curing your own warts. And what you had to do was take 81 stems of oats, bind them into 9 bundles of 9 and hide them under a stone. And as the stems rotted, your warts would disappear.
Hmm. Did people just have a lot more warts and boils back in the day? I feel like...
Yeah, because we had cured them all by doing this oats thing.
Yeah. I just feel like there are many more boil cures that are older than...
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Has anyone here ever had a boil?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I think I had one on tour with all of us on the top of my butt, remember?
Was that the one where you came round to my room and poured oats into my bath? I've had warts on my feet.
Yeah, same. As a kid, you get warts, don't you?
Yeah.
Not sure I've ever had a wart.
Really?
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, podcast at qi.com if you want to give Andy warts.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits, Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everyone. We'd like to let you know that this week we are sponsored by Saily.
Yes, Saily is the app that you can download, which allows you to use the internet on your phone wherever you are on this earth.
That's right. Quite often, like when I've been abroad before, I thought, oh, I'll just use my own data plan. It'll be fine. And then I've come home and the bill has been a little bit on the extortionate side of expensive. So the last time I went abroad, which was to China, I decided I wasn't going to do it this time. I was going to go to Saily. I was going to get myself an eSIM. And honestly, it was so easy. It was so reasonably priced. It was so convenient. It always worked wherever I went. I highly recommend personally to use Saily if you're abroad.
Yes, absolutely. All you need to do is download the app and then you buy a plan. There are multiple plans for over 200 destinations in the world. They have some of the best rates online. And then you install the eSIM and off you go, Googling away, letting the holiday pass you by as you sit in your hotel room looking up weird stuff online.
And if you go to saily.com/fish or you download the Saily app, and you use the offer code FISH, you can get an exclusive 50% discount on Saily data plans.
On with the show.
On with the podcast.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that the world's first electric, internet-connected SUV car, which was designed to help you easily locate parking spots and petrol stations, was Chinese and called the Rong Wei.
Very, very
beautiful.
Nice.
Beautiful.
So, I've just been to China, and I got a car to pick us up from the airport, and it was on an app. And when we arrived there, I looked at the app and it said to look out for Rong Wei. And I thought it was like a joke name that the driver had given himself or something.
Right.
So I Googled it and it turns out that Rover, the car manufacturer, I think went bust in the UK. Mm. But then a Chinese company bought the technology, but not the name. And they made a new name that was kind of a transliterated version of Rover.
Mm.
It's Roewe. But if you pronounce it in pinyin, then you say it Rong Wei. It sounds almost exactly the same as Rong Wei in English.
Rong Wei.
Brilliant.
Yeah, that's, so just further context on the name thing. My Chinese name, which I grew up with in Hong Kong, is Xiebo. Xiebo is Schreiber, Xie and Bo. So, but it doesn't really work because it's Uncle Egg when you put those two words together.
You?
Yeah, my Uncle Chinese Egg. Name is Uncle Egg.
That's kind of cute.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's that nice. Always just caused
you
embarrassment.
You should shave your head.
Mm.
I think you could. It's a good reason you could definitely pull off an Uncle Egg.
Yeah.
And your beard, because eggs aren't hairy on the bottom, are they?
It could be like an egg coming out of the chicken.
Oh, I could you be could an emerging...
Stick- oh, yeah.
That's
egg. Lovely.
That is nice.
Stick a little feather on your face and some bird poo on the other side.
And what's really useful about pinyin is you would use the alphabet that we use in English, but Mandarin has four tones as well. And so if you say a word, often if you just had P-I-N-G, ping, you wouldn't know if it's ping, 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 ping. Mm. So that's what it gives you. On top of each word, it gives you the guidance of the arrow, as it were.
I think what's interesting with that is, like, because Chinese is, like, non-alphabetic, they're always approximate, I think.
Yeah.
That's fair to say. That's why you get sort of, like, a word which is Uncle Egg, but actually...
Yeah.
You can translate those two syllables to something which doesn't say Uncle Egg. It might say...
Disgusting pervert.
I was going to say excellent podcaster, but...
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Well, there are four tones.
There are four tones. And that's why satire in China is actually really good and really subtle, because you are able to make fun of political characters via the use of pinyin and Chinese characters because of the multiple meanings.
And when the government arrests you, do they get to say, I don't like your tone, young man?
Yeah, that's good.
Can I check your fact, James?
Yeah.
You said this was the world's first electric internet-connected SUV car.
According to their website.
So why are you using it to locate petrol stations?
Where do you wash your car?
Good point. I pay the local kids a fiver. And then...
that's a good point, actually. I go to petrol stations to buy food.
Oh, flowers for your wife?
Flowers for my wife.
It's all the best stuff there, isn't it?
Scream wash. Ginster's pasties.
Yeah.
I also go there to wash my car, and often there are charging points in petrol stations. But That's a very good point.
It was just me being flippant, really. I'm really sorry.
No, I think we shouldn't be calling them petrol stations. But you should call them wife flower stations or something. We can't let petrol keep having dominance over the language.
It might be an interesting reason. That's something that is going on in China with electric cars, which is replaceable batteries as opposed to charging your existing battery.
So cool. You just drive over the marks and then the machine does the rest. Mm. And it's especially useful for big, heavy trucks. We're obviously putting in a load of electricity, even at very fast rates, would take a while. But a battery swap, 3 minutes.
That's how the first electric cars were. Someone would come, take out your battery and put a new one in. Yeah. And the reason was it was kind of based on old stagecoaches and stuff where you would take your horses and you would swap your horses over. Mm. And so it was just the obvious thing to do.
Whereas now we plug the horses in, obviously.
But also, like, they're going to get rid of mobile phone integrated batteries, aren't they? That was in the news last week.
Are they?
Yeah, in the EU at least, I think they're going to make it so whenever you buy a new phone, the battery has to be replaceable. You don't just have to get rid of it as soon as the battery goes.
Oh, that's quite good.
That's much better. Yeah. They are the world leaders, aren't they, in electric cars now, China. 65% of electric cars are sold by China because partly because they had massive subsidies. So they have ended up with these electric car graveyards because electric car tech has come on so fast. So, you know, in the early 2010s, I think there was huge investment in the subsidies. Hundreds of companies start making them. And then the year later, everyone says, well, I don't want an electric car that can only drive 20 miles because there's a new one that can drive 50. Yeah. And so there are these giant car parks with thousands of cars in them.
Wow.
So they made last year 31 million cars. Wow. In China. Wow. How many do you think Britain made?
I'll say 1 million. I'm backing Britain.
You slightly overestimated it. 700,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And Mexico, Indonesia and Turkey made more than us last year, as well as the Czech Republic and the big hitters like Germany, India and Japan.
Right.
But it's China's journey to this is so recent, isn't it? It's fascinating. And it's not entirely because of, but a hugely influential person behind it was a guy called Wang Gang. So he's China's Minister of Science and Tech. And he got that job in 2007. But he had been a teenager in the Cultural Revolution. Mm. Really horrible time for all concerned. Mm. Went through that. And then after it ended, after Mao died, he went to university, studied internal combustion engines, worked at Audi, and China bought a load of Audis for, you know, if you get a top government job, you get a really nice government car, which would have been a Western car like an Audi at the time.
Yeah.
And he noticed every time he went home, wow, you know, we're using more and more oil in China. And, oh, yeah, the pollution's getting worse and worse. Wonder if there's anything we could do to change that. And just pitched it to the then minister. And then last year they sold about 8 million electric cars. Plus 5 million hybrids. Like they've just completely overtaken the rest of the world. Yeah.
China is also world leader in car carriers or ro-ros.
I think that's for a boat, isn't it? Row row your boat.
Row row stands for roll on, roll off. And they are car carrying boats. Yeah, yeah. So they are more convenient than lolos, which are lift on, lift offs, for boats carrying any kind of cargo that doesn't have wheels, because you drive cars on and off them.
You get row row ferries, didn't you?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Nice. And China's about to build the world's biggest one, which is going to carry, any guesses on how many cars?
Oh, that would be a lot. 10,000?
Yeah, that's a good guess, actually.
That's a lot.
12,800.
You're kidding.
Pretty good,
that's
right?
That's a lot. Can I ask one more question just on this?
Uh-huh.
China has just built a new snooker building where you can go and play snooker. Mm-hmm. How many snooker tables do you reckon there are in this building?
Nice.
I heard this on TV this week.
Because China is the other center of world snooker apart from Sheffield, right?
Yeah,
it's like Sheffield and China.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go big as an opening. I'm going to say 100,000.
Okay.
One for every 50,000 checkers boards that's currently in existence. That is.
I'm going to bring it back to reality and say 1,000.
Is exactly the right answer. Oh, it's over 1,000.
Oh my God, yes.
1,000 snooker tables in the same room.
It doesn't sound as much now that I dropped my bomb on that.
Your guess then, sorry?
100,000. Well, it's just because 12,800 is far more than I thought could
fit
into.
Yeah. I left a 20p on one of these tables to show I was up next.
Can you finish that? I haven't finished on Roros, but also the stevedores, which is cool because you rarely get to use that word. Stevedores being people who pack and unpack ships. Dozens will work on a ship at once. They have a huge car park full of the cars that need to get on the ship. Let's say 40 stevedores jump in 40 cars, zoom really, really fast because they've got to get 13,000 cars on this ship, drive up the ramp one after the other, pin them down, and then they will jump on a minibus, get back there, and then speed the other cars up. Wow. It's so cool.
That's really cool. That's way better. I recently got the ferry from Dover to Calais, and it was a very different experience. There were no stevedores as far as I could see. When we came back into Dover, we got stuck for an hour because it had to reverse out and say, sorry, the ship's not long enough to reach the port. They do this trip every day.
What do you mean it's not long enough?
It's not long enough. We had to repark it in a different parking spot.
That's amazing.
Wild.
The whole scale of this stuff in China is just nuts, isn't it? So we have just had the Beijing Motor Show, which has pretty much overtaken any other motor show in the world. You know, it used to be Detroit or whatever.
Okay.
It's now Beijing. So in one of the halls at the Beijing Motor Show recently, one of the halls had more electric cars, like models, than are for sale in the whole USA. Amazing. And there were 17 halls at the Beijing Motor Show.
Everything's just huge in China.
This was my memory of it. Apparently it's still the case. Seatbelts are really hated by Chinese drivers and they often don't do it, but they get in a lot of trouble if they get pulled over by the police. So one way around it was this company started releasing t-shirts that were white t-shirts with a seatbelt pattern over the shirts. And that became a massive craze and police had to pull over more people than usual to see if it was the shirt or an actual seatbelt. And the problem is most cars these days have the noise that goes off, the alarm, if you've not got your seatbelt on. Mm-hmm. So there was a big craze of sort of blingified seatbelt buckles without the strap on it that you put in to confuse the car into thinking that the seatbelt was in. That's but you clever. Would get like Pokemon versions, or you would get Snoopy or Winnie the Pooh. Yeah,
because that is annoying when you have a bag and you put it on the passenger seat and then your car for the next 5 hours says they're not wearing the seatbelt.
Yeah.
Or a baby, same thing. The key is to just do the seatbelt up behind you.
Right.
Problem solved.
My grandmother used to just hold it across her. Like she just wouldn't plug it in. She would just pull it out and then hold it across her.
Because she was a generation that were against it on principle, right?
Well, there was ridiculous like a theory, wasn't there? Like, if you're in a crash, you don't want to wear a seatbelt because you want to be flung away from the wreckage.
A car's just crashed. I want to be as far away from it as possible.
In 1907, there was a Peking to Paris race, which was a big deal for cars in China at the time. But the Chinese suspected that all the racers were spies because they were mostly Europeans who had come over. Mm. And some of these cars, they had like the mud guards on the car. They were specially arranged so you could take them off and you could use them as planks whenever you needed to drive over a swamp.
Oh, cool.
That's so cool.
And in Kazan in Russia, because it had to go through Russia, two youths fled in terror when they saw the car because they'd never seen one before. And in Nizhny Novgorod, one of the cars frightened a horse and the locals started throwing stones at the drivers because they were like, oh, you come over here frightening our horses. The winner was a guy called Prince Scipione Borghese. And he was so far ahead of all the other cars, he was 17 days ahead at one point, that he attended 4 days of celebration in Moscow halfway through the race, and he still won by a week.
That's really funny.
The first sort of car was in China.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, made in China. 1680s, car number one.
What? No, hang on. Come on.
Car number one, 1680s. Car number two, 1890s or something. But yeah, car number one, this was made by a Flemish Jesuit missionary. So it was a nice merging of East and West back then. A guy called Ferdinand Verbiest. It was Qing dynasty, and he invented a car which was steam-powered with coal powering it, which is pretty amazing.
Sorry, 1680?
Correct. Didn't even really have steam-powered stuff then.
Who would have been Andy alive to experience this?
Oh, what a good question. Well, not Oliver or Richard Cromwell, sadly, of course.
This Verbiest guy, did he drive, run, travel?
I see what you're doing because of the name. Yeah,
he was Verbi. The Verbiest guy.
Yeah, that's very brilliant. Good. The only problem with...
That's not the worst joke you'll hear today.
It was 65 centimetres long, and it was actually a toy for the emperor.
Oh, come on.
But it still works. You could squeeze into that. If you're desperate, you can squeeze into a 65 centimetre.
How fast would it?
It's just a runaround, and it's good for parking.
Yeah. It didn't say how fast it went, but it could go for an hour before it needed more coal.
Amazing.
And he's interesting because he's the only Westerner ever to have received an honorary name after death in China. So if you've done something impressive in China, the emperor would give you a name after you died.
Oh, wow. Right.
And the emperor really liked him because he did other cool stuff. And so he was called Qin Min, which means diligent and clever.
Nice.
Very nice.
Can I tell you one of my other Chinese electric car heroes?
Yeah, go on.
Wang Chuanfu. Uh-huh. So he's the head of BYD.
Oh, and they're the biggies.
They used to make batteries for mobile phones, and then they got via that into bigger batteries and then thought, no, you know what? Cars. He once showed investors, he was at a meeting with, you know, Warren Buffett?
Yeah,
sure do.
Who was at Berkshire Hathaway, his huge investment firm. BYD, in their very early days, were trying to get investment from Warren Buffett. And at an investor meeting, Wang Chuanfu once showed investors how clean and safe his batteries were by drinking from a glass of battery fluid in front of him.
What?
Wow. He just said, look, this stuff is great.
Wait, but that isn't that... I don't need it to be drinkable.
I know. Yes, also, it's unclear what point he was making, actually.
Is it not highly acidic battery fluid?
I guess his stuff was not.
Right.
He didn't drop down dead as part of the PR stunt.
Oh, sorry, I forgot to say. He dropped down dead as part of the PR. But he got the deal. That was very impressive.
Okay, it is time for fact number 3, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that the reason a World War II bomb whistled as it fell from the sky is because it had a big whistle on it.
Is this a specific bomb we're talking about, or is it all the bombs?
It wouldn't have been every single bomb. Absolutely. That's right. But these are German bombs. And the idea was it was an intimidation tactic.
Like the Blitz ones.
Yeah.
Those ones.
Yeah. Right, okay. It would have been those, because a lot of the memories of people during the Blitz talk about the whistling sound of the bomb as it came down. And the Germans decided that they wanted to use this as a tactic. So they literally attached a whistle-like device to the fins of the bomb, so that as it came down, it created that sound.
Whereas when we now go, we think, oh, that's just the sound of a bomb. But actually, it's not. It's the sound of a whistle.
I actually think it's the sound of something falling. Like in my head, it's like Wile E. Coyote makes that sound, right?
Yeah.
When you're right.
Falling. So I just thought it was, I never really thought about it. And if I did think about it, I would know it was wrong. But I kind of just thought, oh, things that fall just go like that.
Yeah. But that will have come from the bombs, right? Yeah.
Because
the
sound gets... It's getting deeper, yeah?
Yeah.
Mm.
But as we know from the Doppler effect,
yeah.
If there's a police siren driving past you or something, it would get higher as it approached you and then deeper as it went further away again.
It's because movies have tricked us.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whistle that you hear in the movies is the perspective of the pilot, not the person on the ground.
We should do...
I've started doing that since I read... since I read this and was like, oh, yeah, of course. You know, with kids, when you feed them, you go... as an aeroplane.
Yeah.
I've started doing as it descends into his mouth.
It's interesting because it was used as a sort of intimidation tactic. I read an account by a guy called Harold Troughton, who in 1941, he was a young boy, and he remembers being in his kitchen and he hears the noise of the bomb coming down. And so they immediately jumped under the table, because many tables had cages underneath them as a bomb protection device. Mm. Turns out it was the neighbor's kettle whistling, and that's how sensitive everyone was at the time, specifically to that sound.
There was loads of it around in the war.
Bombs?
So, loads of bombs. Yeah. No, loads of noise being used to a certain extent psychologically.
Throughout all of history.
All of history.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. So the Stuka plane, which was the Junkers 87, JU-87, they had little fan-like whistling devices put on because they were dive bombing planes. So the idea is you dive down as close as possible to the target, release the bombs when you're really close so they land accurately, and then you fly off again. But they were fitted with special devices which made them scream. Mm. And it was a very terrifying sound to hear, the scream of this Stuka plane. But it did slow them down a bit, by about 15 miles an hour. So they took them off eventually because made them easier to shoot down. You
well,
know?
Like, do you remember the Night Witches, who we've mentioned before? Mm. The Soviet female pilots. And they were in really old rickety planes because they gave them, like, the wooden planes. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't go very high. But they were very noisy because they were old. And they used sound because it would just disrupt people's sleep. you were on edge all the time, or also like you would have to use anti-aircraft stuff in the middle of the night so no one could get any sleep. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a psychological thing in that way that you disrupt. Yeah. I think it's called harassing fire, it's known as. Oh. Which is where you deliberately do something just to harass people and not necessarily to bomb them.
Well, the famous example in the Second World War that our grandparents always used to talk about was the doodlebugs, wasn't it? The doodlebug was basically a German drone, essentially.
Is that the V1?
Yes, the V1, right. Which it would be fired, and it was sort of like powered by a sort of jet as it went through the air, and it was programmed to stop at a certain point. And the famous thing about the doodlebug, which everyone always remembers, is that when its engine was programmed to cut out, that was when it plummets out of the air. So you hear that poop, 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 and then a sudden silence, which actually a friend of mine in the village, Laurie, is in his early 90s, and he still remembers whenever you heard that silence, you know, you probably don't have time to save yourself at that point.
Well, right. He must be very happy to live next door to someone with a young child. Never any silence.
Never quiet, yeah.
The V2, which was the successor rocket, you don't have that psychological nightmare of hearing it and then cut out, because it's going so fast that you don't hear it. You just hear a big bang.
Right.
Well, if you hear the big bang, you know you haven't been killed by it.
Mm. That's a good point. Relief.
I mean, they're both bad.
They're but both not as bad as the Big Bang Theory.
No. If you hear that, you know. Oh, no.
You long for silence.
Here's an interesting whistling bomb. In 1965, the Attack Squadron 25, the American squadron, toilet bombed Vietnam. So they wanted to mark the fact that they dropped £6 million of ordnance on the country, and they did it by taking an old toilet, taking it up on the plane and then dropping it out. Oh. And because of the holes in the toilet or something, it just whistled all the way down.
Right.
And that's to commemorate how much they've dropped on Vietnam.
It's just like soldiers, you know.
Soldiers being soldiers.
Soldiers being soldiers, yeah. But actually, previously in the Korean War, there was a kitchen sink bomb that was dropped on Korea because someone had said, we've dropped everything on them except the kitchen sink. And so they deliberately just got a kitchen sink and dropped it down as well.
Gosh, nice. You've got to make your own fun, haven't you, in war? I guess your sense of humour changes a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah. I like this real nonchalance in an article I read from Time magazine in 1940. Because so it's September 1940, this was written, so middle of the Battle of Britain. Mm-hmm. And it said, last week, while screaming bombs were falling on London, C. Martin Wilbur, curator at Chicago's Museum of Natural History, called attention to the exhibit of Chinese whistling arrows and used the Blitz as a way to segue into ancient Chinese whistling arrows.
Nice.
But these were the precursor, so these were arrows that were hollow on the inside, and so they whistled as they flew, and they were to frighten people. And the Manchu emperor used them to scare people off the streets when he was walking through, so they couldn't harm people, the ones that he used.
How interesting. Genghis Khan used those as well.
Yeah.
That was a biggie. And that was more so used as an intimidation tactic prior to a siege. So if the noise and the confusion, it'd scare horses if you had all these arrows and this noise coming. So it would cause chaos amongst the enemy, and then you make your strike.
That was kind of like one of the earliest things in war, wasn't it, to scare the horses? That's why you would use... You're scaring the opponents as well, but scaring the horses was a really big deal. And then people started using elephants in warfare, and noise is really good against elephants because elephants are like really weirdly skittish about loud noises.
Hey,
yeah, they really are.
Perhaps I too am an elephant. So they get annoyed.
Well, don't show us that party trick again, Andy. They have very sensitive hearing, elephants. And so Alexander the Great learned that a good thing to do when battling against people who had elephants was to get a load of pigs and trumpets, make the pigs squeal and blow the trumpets, and then the elephants would run away.
I know, you know, if you're one of his cavalrymen and he's, do you want a pig or a trumpet to carry on your horse? Like when he's run out of trumpets, you've drawn the short straw, haven't you?
But if everyone's going hungry, you can't eat the trumpet.
Good point.
So it's, it's a mixed blessing.
That's true.
Yeah. Is that just because elephants have got really big ears that their hearing is so good?
I think some of the hearing goes through their feet as well, doesn't it?
Right.
I think they just don't like vibrations.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know, because they don't like bees either, do they? Like, because of the buzzing of the bees.
Yeah, they hate bees.
Not the stings, the buzz.
Yeah.
And mice.
Is that true? I thought,
no,
okay.
It's cartoons.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but we're dealing with whistling bombs falling. So, you know, yeah. I did find tvtropes.com, which advised me on the whistling bombs thing.
Oh, yeah.
Said, please remember, if you should ever find yourself in an area often bombarded from the sky, that not all projectiles make such a sound. If you are informed something deadly may land nearby, you should duck or take cover, even if you don't hear the whistle. I think if you're taking your advice, if you're in a bombardment situation and you're reading... You're on tvtropes.com.
Well, look, I tried to speak to the buffins at fun.com. I think these days it's like the buzz of a drone, isn't it?
Yes.
You're in trouble.
We do get to hear a close example of a whistling bomb in London these days. When would you have heard that? On nights of celebration, on bonfire night, fireworks. The whistling sound, it's a manufactured sound that's attached to it. And so like all these things, like the toilet has a hole in it, has holes. It's not even by holes. It's a chemical mix. It's called whistle mix. And whistle mix, yeah. Potassium benzoate is used.
I'm going to start a tribute act of Little Mix called Whistle Mix. We just play very high-pitched.
For dogs.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And is it the fireworks? It's because they're going further away.
It's because they're going away. It's the Doppler.
They're doing the right thing.
They're doing the right way around.
They're doing it the right way around. They're obeying the laws of physics. Thanks, fireworks.
My favourite bomb disposal person, as we're on bombs.
Yeah.
Have you heard of Peter Gurney? He was this massive hero of bomb disposal. And obviously, people who do bomb disposal are unbelievably brave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Particularly when you're dealing with bombs that, for example, have been planted, whether it's a car bomb, like a Second World War bomb, or a bomb that's been fired and then not gone off. They're all kind of made in a factory, right? So you know roughly how to do them. You know, people have known how to defuse particular bombs.
Can I just say, Andy, I actually think the people who defuse those are quite brave as well.
Okay, well, yeah, I guess. That's true. But the really brave people... No, when you're like, if it's like an IRA bomb or something, which has just been made by an enthusiastic amateur.
What's that TV show where that woman goes around defusing bombs?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, it's Trigger Point.
Fictional.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
No, it's a real TV show.
So Peter Gurney did this. He diffused thousands of bombs over his career. Uh-huh. It was in Berlin and Egypt and Libya. But he just had to walk towards them, you know, knowing nothing about the structure, and then like seeing what was there. And because they have tricks on them. Yeah. Which are
so what would
he
use? Intuition? Well, like how could you possibly use any logic unlogical thing?
Lots of experience. Or like if one part of it is removed, then that'll trigger another bit and you have to work that out. So he would often use medical scalpels, a ball of string, garden secateurs and fish hooks. And then this moment happened in 1991 in February. Some shells were fired at 10 Downing Street and more in the middle of town. One landed in the garden of 10 Downing Street. Hugely dangerous. He has to walk towards it, but the buildings around there are really tall, so he has no radio signal.
Is this Thatcher era?
John Major, it would have been. Okay. So he has to straddle this bomb, right? And what he's armed with is a twig and a spanner that he's borrowed from the Prime Minister's boiler, okay?
Why didn't he bring his equipment?
I guess I don't know why he didn't have it with him, but it was an immediate, urgent thing. He didn't have time to go and get it. It's just landed in...
Bet that happens to him all the time.
Prime Minister, have you got any secateurs? No, but I've got this spanner from my boiler.
And my lucky twig.
I mean, so he was sitting astride the bomb, and this is from his obituary. By the way, he died last year, age 93. He survives this. Okay. He was conscious of an intense heat through his fire-resistant trousers. So he's remembered to put his fire-resistant trousers on. I don't know why he doesn't have his kit. But
Prime Minister, do you have any clothing that I can use?
I do have these fire-resistant trousers.
But as he put it in his autobiography, Braver Men Walk Away, he suddenly realised that if he didn't do something quickly, he would never again sing anything other than soprano. So he has to hop off the bomb, scoop up some snow from a nearby snowdrift, because it's February, shove it down his trousers, and then get back on the bomb. And he manages it. He defuses it.
Wow.
Incredible. And like I say, he lived to the age of 93 and he died last year.
Bravo.
Peter
Gurney. I can't believe he needed to be straddling it rather than just next to it. Because people have used that excuse with me in this.
That was also John Major's excuse with Edwina Curry.
Well, I've got one other old ancient whistling noise to intimidate. Yes. It's the Aztec death whistle. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the 1990s, they were doing some excavations in New Mexico when they found this boy who was in a temple underground, dead. Okay. Holding
a long time ago, right?
A long time ago,
dead.
So expected, like, not
we're
not
too that's late.
Not, not the surprising bit. Okay,
so he was holding in one of his hands this object that no one had really seen before, and it was called the Aztec death whistle from then on. And you would blow into it, and it would make a noise that sounded like a wind. Everyone thought maybe it was used for rituals when wind wasn't available. And they're not sure whether or not, there's lots of theories, but might have been used in the war field to intimidate people. And so I happen to know someone who owns a modern death whistle, Aztec death whistle. And so I reached out to them to give us a sample. So this is a friend of the podcast. So here we go.
Bit of death whistle there for you by Reese Derby.
Yeah, so thank you, Reese.
But knowing Reese, that could have been just him screaming.
So. I do have questions if that was just him. But
I've read about those death whistles, and I think we might have done it on QI, or we might have thought about doing it on QI, that probably the modern ones are bigger and they're deliberately made to make screaming noises, and the original ones, like you say, are more windy based.
I think and some people are trying to push that they were used on the battlefield, but again, we've got so little info about it, but it was found in this temple. But that scream is a very realistic sounds like a woman wailing.
It sounded like Reese Darby wailing.
I'll check with them.
Sounds like Reese Darby wailing after he sat on a hot bomb.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show. That is Andy.
My fact is, flatworms sometimes grow heads at both ends by mistake.
How do we know they're doing it by mistake?
Yeah.
Would you do it on purpose?
For a party trick, yeah.
Yeah, they do. They normally grow them the right way around, and occasionally things go wrong.
I see.
That's why we think it's by mistake.
Okay.
Yeah, scientists haven't done the requisite interviews to find out if this is just like a fun thing for them. So, right, flatworms, right? These are, for anyone who's not familiar, these are just, I mean, they're as they sound, they're flatworms. They're not your fancy, posh, ringed worms.
They're not even related to earthworms, really, are they?
No.
Like things that you get in your garden. These are completely different.
These just like useless little flat worms.
What?
You know,
No.
Okay, well, we've got a disagreement of opinion about them. But I think
they're only flat at the edges, like toasties, like those jackals. That's what they remind me of.
Yeah. Well, they're very ancient life forms, obviously. And There are loads of different species of them. Some of them breed by just separating themselves in two. These are the ones that if you cut the head off, they grow another head.
Mm.
Or if you cut it in two, it becomes two worms. Or if you cut off a tiny bit, it grows a whole new worm from that.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine if I, right now, grew a head in like roughly where my stomach is.
Oh. Yeah.
And then everything above that head grows a new pair of legs from there.
Does the head look exactly the same as yours? Yes. Or does it look like a brother?
I think it's a cloning thing.
Okay.
So there's a new Andy's head in the middle of my stomach.
Yeah.
Okay. And then from above that, I just grow new legs and hips and everything. And then that Andy has my legs already.
Why has it got the same name? I would give it a different name because that's going to get confusing. Even if it's Andy 2, that's better than Andy.
Okay, yeah, sorry. So Andy 2 gets my old legs.
Right.
Does Andy 1 and Andy 2 communicate with each other? Do they? How are you doing down there?
We're not close. We're not friends, but like, right. we're colleagues.
Yeah, I mean that's as close as you get to a friend, isn't
Absolutely.
It? Really. Look, I know you grew out of my body. I just don't think we're quite there yet.
So that's how the flatworms do it. Right?
Wait, yeah. I didn't understand that explanation.
I don't.
Even though it was really good. So you're saying it grows out of your tummy, and then he keeps your original legs.
Yeah, yeah.
But some new legs grow higher up your body.
Yeah,
than you get to have.
Old Andy, me, yeah. I grow new legs.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And
got
he
it.
Gets my legs and he grows a new head, right?
Well, lucky him, because you have very long legs where you keep a lot of your height.
It certainly is. I've got a real job growing another pair of legs as long and lissome as those, but.
No one said listen, but okay.
And sometimes these flatworms get it wrong, right?
Oh, dear.
They will grow a second head. This is quite confusing. They grow a second head halfway up them, facing the right way. But then at the bottom of the top half, so old Andy, right, me, I accidentally grow another head after separating off. So I, Andy, am now a head at this end and a head at the other end as well.
Oh, is your new bottom head, is that facing upside down or the right way
Are
up?
You like the king of clubs?
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Right.
Facing the wrong way.
And you've got no legs now. Right? Or do you also still grow the legs?
Well, I'm a worm in this, so it doesn't matter.
But you've got to move.
You just said you grow new... If it goes right, you grow new legs.
That was the analogy I was
trying
to...
But actually, good point. Worms don't have legs. Hang on.
In this whole analogy, whenever Andy says legs, you have to imagine it's the tail of a worm.
Right. I don't think I can have made it any clearer than I have done.
I think you're right.
So let's imagine Andy 1 and Andy 2.
Yeah.
Okay. Andy 1... has now got two heads and has no tail.
Yeah.
How are you going to poo?
Don't know.
You don't know?
Haven't thought this through, have you?
We've consulted with each other, neither of us know.
And that's why I said by mistake in my original fact, because I do think this is an error. Do you know, James?
I do know.
How am I going to poo?
Well, the lucky thing is that flatworms poo and eat in the same hole.
Yes.
Ah. That's not lucky for most of your life, but in this specific instance where you have two heads, it doesn't matter so much because you can poo out of your mouth.
Nice. But surely, I'm sorry, this is now getting a bit gross, but if I've got a head at either end, aren't things heading the other way towards Andy too? I'm not going to have to poo out anything he's been eating, nor me.
You would eat it and poo it out of your face, and then Andy 2 will eat it and poo it out of his face.
Okay, that's fine.
You'd have to come to a compromise if it was that other version, wouldn't you? You'd take turns in eating and then being the anus for the meal, wouldn't you?
Oh, I thought like no curries or something.
Oh, right. Yeah. Because you don't want to be a date and then suddenly you're just pooing out your mouth.
Yeah. I don't think I'm going on many dates.
Let me tell you about my lissom legs, for God's sake.
Over there, there's Andy with two sets of legs upside down. He's surrounded by women.
The thing about the heads coming off and the new heads coming is the new heads have the same memories, and we don't understand that. So
it's crazy.
They tested this with planarian flatworms, a kind of flatworm. They trained them up on a half on a rough surface, half on a smooth surface. And then they got them to find food all on a rough surface. And the ones who've been trained on a rough surface darted to the food because they like traveling on it. The ones who've been raised on the smooth surface were like, oh, what's this rough surface? Anyway, then they cut all the heads off. And then when the new heads came back, the heads that had been raised on the rough surface remembered to be chill about the rough surface. It's like a really complicated way of showing they have memories. I don't know why they didn't just ask, you know, do you remember 9/11 or whatever? But that's how they did it. And they remember their upbringing, even though it's a different head.
They do really stupid experiments with these things, though, don't they?
Yeah.
Because they're so wacky, they want to see what their limits are.
Yeah.
So there's a guy called James McConnell in 1964 who put some flatworms in a maze and taught them how to complete the maze. And then he chopped them up and fed them to another flatworm.
Mm.
What?
And then put that flatworm into the maze, and the flatworm could also complete the maze without being taught how to do it. And his theory was that basically they had learned through their food.
Interesting.
Is it like talking to them from inside?
Well, it turns out that no one's been able to replicate this experiment. And what they think happened is the first flatworm left a load of slime in the maze and the second one just followed the slime.
Oh. He didn't clean the maze out. That's loose.
But given what we know about them, given that they can regenerate memories after being decapitated, I mean, it sounds like that experiment was flawed, but it's crazy what they can do.
Yeah.
What can they do?
They can regrow their head and remember.
I thought you meant once it's regrown, what they can do.
Well, we know someone who can't remember things even with the same head. But it is just nuts, isn't it? Like, if we could harness these abilities, we'd be unstoppable.
We would.
If we could, they can regrow from 1/279th of their original mass.
That's insane.
Whoa.
So I don't know what that is for a human. It must be your little finger or something.
Yeah. And there's so many firsts in the flatworm world. They're incredibly old. They're about 839 million years old. Wow. I'm going to take away the about because that's a very precise number.
Yeah.
They are 839 million years old.
Uh-huh.
They're probably the first hunter and the first thing that moved with any kind of purpose rather than just floating like plankton. So they chose what direction to go and moved. They're the first animals with a nervous system, a head, a brain, eyes. They're the first animal ever to internally fertilize rather than just leaving eggs around. And they were the first bilaterally symmetrical animals, i.e. ones with left and right sides, like pretty much all animals we know today. They pioneered that, having a left and right side. So obviously you get like jellyfish and stuff or stuff that's symmetrical in lots of directions.
Mm.
But and I was looking up asymmetrical animals. There are some really cool, can you think of asymmetrical animals?
An amoeba?
Are they
symmetrical?
Yeah, I guess so.
I know what you mean, but they're just as likely to be blobby on one side as the other, right? It's not like they'll always have this on the left and always have that on the right.
What
I
are
was
we
thinking like starfish, but I don't think they are they?
They're symmetrical. I'm talking like fiddler crabs.
Oh, fiddler crabs, yeah, because they have one massive claw.
A massive claw.
Oh.
Flatfish. Nice. Remember the eye migrates around a flatfish so that it has two eyes on one side?
Javelin throwers.
Oh. Javelin throwers and Rafa Nadal, yeah.
Chronic masturbator.
Fiddler people.
Welcome back, Anna.
Thanks very much. Yeah. So,
did you read about the new flatworm they discovered that was named after COVID?
No.
Humbertium covidium. They just named it after that because a lot of the study was written during lockdown. Mm. But there's another flatworm called Hancock anus, which has nothing to do with COVID, surprisingly. but they get involved with penis fencing.
Penis fencing?
It's because they're all hermaphroditic. They're always fighting over who will be the one that puts their sperm into the other one. And the way that they do it is by a little bit of a penis fight, and then the winner gets to inseminate the other one.
Yeah, because it's worse to be pregnant, as I personally know, than to not be pregnant.
Yeah, but at least they get 9 months off.
Off.
Wow. I'll see you after the show, James.
I was reading about the native and non-native flatworms, because they're great, they're very interesting, but lots of them are not native to the UK, and they absolutely decimate normal earthworms.
Because
they hunt them, they kill them, and native earthworms, which are really good for soil, obviously, and are brilliant in all sorts of ways, just get written off when flatworms invade. That's because we're trading plants and trading soil and stuff. But as a result of this, I found and joined the the Earthworm Society of Britain.
Oh, that's nice.
Membership is £5 per year.
Okay.
How did these guys make any money? And all of these people that you join, like the Lighthouse Keepers Association or the Wallpaper Association, they're getting so little money from you.
Well, those guys are 25 quid. This was a fiver. It didn't say anywhere what you get for the fiver, but I was so excited by that point that I just joined.
Maybe you sponsor an earthworm. You'll get letters from it.
I think you got it cheaper because you got an early bird discount.
Beautiful. Why isn't that on their website? I'll tell you what happens when my membership is processed. I'm very excited.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's it. You're a member.
Yeah.
Okay. Looking forward to installment two of that. Thank God for James's joke. Everyone's going to think they forgot to put in the end of that anecdote. There wasn't one, guys.
What happens is, Anna, I've developed this tactic where I just say something and then these guys save me.
That was my thing. Did you guys come across the Myers tapeworm trap?
The Myers
tapeworm trap?
Yes.
No.
So tapeworms are a kind of flatworm, famous for living in your tummy and eating all your food. And they're things that you don't necessarily want living inside you. Mm. And so in 1854, a doctor called Alpheus Myers patented a trap. And it's so good. I don't know why it wasn't mass produced, actually. It's a hollow tube made of gold that contains a bit of cheese.
What?
Stop it. What?
And you swallow the trap. Uh-huh. You leave it in your tummy. And as he explains, the worm will eventually seize the cheese. You have to fast for a few days so that the worm's really hungry. It will seize the cheese and then the trap will spring shut on it and trap it, and then you can pull it out with the string. So he says, and he says the convenient thing is you can just fix the cord that hangs out of your mouth somewhere on your shirt.
Right.
A bit like a baby's dummy. Right. I guess. So you can go about your day.
But it's dangling out of your mouth all the time.
Yes. Yeah. But eventually he says you'll feel a tugging and you'll see the string move. And it'll be the tapeworm tugging on the cheese. And at that point, you just pull the string up and you extract the tapeworm.
I have a question. Yeah. I have a few. Isn't your body constantly trying to process and push this tube through you?
Yeah.
Because you've swallowed it and that's how your intestines function.
The peristalsis would take it down to your stomach. But I think it could theoretically stay there if you've got something else.
Yeah,
so if
holding
it's tethered.
It.
So stomach, okay. I thought tapeworms were in your lower intestine or something.
You know what, Andy? Well done. You've highlighted the flaw in his plan. The tapeworm couldn't have got up to the tummy. So it was actually a perfect invention, except for the fact that it wasn't the
right organ.
But could
he not just shove this golden trap up his ass?
Yeah. As I'm sure a lot of early potential investors told him.
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found online. I'm on @Schreiberland on Instagram. James?
My Instagram is no such thing as James Harkin.
Andy?
Mine is @AndrewHunterM.
And you can get us as a group. Where, Anna?
God, I can't remember. online?
Yep.
No such thing as fish.com. Or you can email podcast@qi.com.
Correct.
Or
we're on Instagram.
Do Instagram @ no such thing or TikTok probably.
Yeah. Otherwise, just come back next week because we're going to be back here with another episode and we'll see you then. Goodbye.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.